The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started with the second panel here. And my name is Munir Ahmed. I teach in the International Human Rights Clinic. I also teach immigration law. I will give a little bit more of an introduction to myself and the rest of our panelists in just a second. I just want to make a couple of announcements, events that might be of interest to people. On Thursday, October 5th, which is next Thursday, a week from this Thursday, there's an all-day long Guantanamo teach-in. This is a national program that's being put on. There are people here, students here in particular, who've been very actively involved in the planning of it. It has both a video cast and a live component to it. And I just want to go over very briefly the topics that will be covered there and encourage people to attend. It will be in this room, the video cast. There also will be some live panels. Professor Wilson and I believe myself and possibly others will be talking about the case of Omar Khadr, which some of you heard about in the earlier portion of this morning's program. He's the client that we represent at Guantanamo. There'll be a program on journalists looking behind the wire, including three prominent journalists who've covered Guantanamo for the last few years. Another session on matters of faith, Guantanamo, and religious communities. A session on American detention policy, including Guantanamo. A session on the military and the commander-in-chief. And a session on medical professionals and Guantanamo. There's some information out front about it. There's a flyer, Guantanamo teach-in, and you should see things around school about it. So I want to encourage you all to attend that if you find the topics that are being discussed here of interest. The other thing I just want to mention briefly is that the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law, which has put on this program and done all the work to pull it together, has evaluation forms out front. And so if you could please just take a minute to fill it out, it would be very helpful to the center in doing future planning for programs like this. All right, that's it by way of administrative detail. As I said, my name is Munir Ahmed. In addition to being on the faculty here, I am one of the civilian co-counsel with Professor Wilson and Professor Husky, as well as students in our International Human Rights Clinic, representing Omar Khadr, the youngest detainee at Guantanamo Bay, and one of the 10 who had previously been referred before a military commission. I am serving as moderator here today, and I will endeavor to be as dispassionate as a moderator as I am as an advocate, and no more so and no less. I also just want to say very briefly, give very brief introductions of our panelists. Again, you have longer bios in the program, but just so we have a sense of who is here with us. To my right is Gene Fidel. Gene heads the military practice group at Felsman Tucker Leifer Fidel. He's also the president of the National Institute of Military Justice. To Gene's right is my colleague in the International Human Rights Clinic, Christine Husky. Christine just started teaching with us. She previously had been at Sherman and Sterling for 8 years.
Yes, don't remind me.
Where, among other things, she worked on the Rasool case that established the right of habeas corpus of detainees at Guantanamo from the very beginning, from the district court level all the way up to the Supreme Court and back down. To Christine's right, my friend in the green polyester, Major Tom Fleener. Tom, Major Fleener, has been assigned to defend one of the detainees at Guantanamo, Ali Hamza al-Bahul, and he has been involved in the commission practice for a little bit over a year now. And last but not least, to Tom's right, is Brigadier General Thomas Hemingway. General Hemingway is a legal advisor to the appointing authority for the Office of Military Commissions, and that is the convening power for the old military commission process, presumably for a new one if it's created as well. With that, by way of introductions, here's what we have in mind for the format. I'm going to try to provide in 7 or 8 minutes just an overview of issues that are presented at this point in the aftermath of Hamdan with an eye toward creating a new military commission system. Mention was made, for those of you who are at the morning session, that there are various legislative proposals that have been floating around. It's expected that there will be action in Congress on one of these by the end of this week. And we are going to spend our time focusing on the legislation. What I'm going to try to do is to just provide a brief overview of that legislation and try to highlight what I see to be five or six of the major issues that are presented. I'm then going to ask each panelist to take about 5 minutes to provide us with some initial reactions, responses, corrections, anything that they want to say in response to what I set out. What we're then going to do is spend some time going in greater depth into four or five of those topics, hopefully engaging the panelists with one another and also taking questions from you. So I think many of you were here for the morning session and benefited from the rich discussion of the Hamdan decision, but let me just say very briefly how it is that we come to be talking about legislation here today with regard to military commissions. The Hamdan case in June struck down the old military commission system as violative of the Uniform Code of Military Justice and of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. It violated the UCMJ because the UCMJ requires that military commissions be specifically authorized by Congress and can't be unilaterally authorized by the executive. It also violated the Uniform Code of Military Justice because the structure and procedures of commissions impermissibly deviated from the rules of court-martial without a specific finding of impracticability. With regard to the Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, the Supreme Court found a violation here because the old commission system failed to comply with the requirement that a detainee be tried by, and here I'm quoting, a regularly constituted court affording all the judicial guarantees which are recognized as indispensable by civilized peoples. Now, in his concurring opinion, Justice Breyer more or less invited Congress to take action to grant specific authorization to the president to conduct military commissions, and that, in fact, is what Congress has endeavored to do over the past few months. By my count, there have been at least five, possibly six different versions of a military commission bill that have circulated since about July. Last week, the administration struck a deal with three Republican holdouts, Senators Graham, Warner, and McCain, to reach a compromise bill in the Senate. And as we went about planning for this discussion today, we were going on the assumption that that was the bill we'd be talking about. As it turns out, around 9 or 10 o'clock last night, there was a bill introduced in the House, which I understand Senator Frist may try to introduce in the Senate as well. It has some pretty significant and material differences from the Senate version. I don't know that we'll be able to get into those in much detail today. Suffice it to say that the situation is fluid and dynamic. Nonetheless, I think that many of the salient features of the compromise bill from the Senate remain very much on the agenda, and therefore that's where we're going to focus our attention today. So now turning to the major features of the compromise bill, and again, my goal here is to flag these for more in-depth discussion by our panelists. The problem of congressional authorization seemingly will be addressed if, in fact, some legislation is passed by Congress. Left open is whether the proposed commission system will comply with Common Article 3, and that's a question, an overarching question that I hope we'll take up in just a few minutes. Other questions that have not yet been addressed by the courts might also be hovering in the background. So, for example, do the commission procedures under the new proposed bill comply with Article 75 of Protocol 1 of the Geneva Convention of 1949? That's something that Professor Goldman raised in the previous panel and that the plurality opinion suggests may be applicable. Another question that may be hovering in the background, do the proposed procedures of the military commission, the new military commission system, comply with the Due Process Clause? That question rests on a predicate issue of whether the Due Process Clause is available to the detainees at Guantanamo. That's a question that has not been resolved by the courts. In fact, in the context of the military commissions, it hasn't yet even been raised. And then getting beyond these questions of legality, assuming that the military commission system as proposed in the legislation is in fact lawful, there is a set of policy questions. Is this a good way to do it among the variety of choices that are available? All right, that's by way of overview. Here are five issues that I'd like to highlight for our panelists to engage on. First are a set of evidentiary issues. I think Major Fleener is going to take these up most directly, but hopefully other panelists will address them as well. Issues that many of you may be familiar with just from the popular media coverage of the commissions. Questions around the admissibility of coerced statements, admissibility of hearsay, the use of classified information, and the associated right to be present at one's own trial. A second set of issues that I want to flag here for our conversation has to do with the substantive charges that the compromise bill proposes to make triable by military commission. Now, what's interesting here is that, and this came up in a question after the last panel about a concern about ex post facto. Can Congress now establish new crimes triable by military commission that weren't crimes before without running afoul of the ex post facto clause? The proposed legislation says that it is merely declarative of existing law, particularly existing law of war, and that it codifies offenses, and here I'm quoting, that have traditionally been triable by military commissions, unquote. I read that to be an attempt to get around the ex post facto problem, saying we're not creating new offenses, we're merely codifying law of war offenses that have always existed, certainly existed at the time of the alleged offenses with which people might be charged. Now, this is undoubtedly true with respect to some charges that are included in the legislation. For example, murder of protected persons, unquestionably a violation of the laws of war. But it seems the statement that these are charges that have traditionally been triable by military commissions seems to me demonstrably false with regard to other charges. Terrorism, for example, is listed as a charge triable by military commission. I know of no military commission in history that has ever tried an individual on the charge of terrorism. Similarly, conspiracy, which was mentioned earlier, at least four justices in Hamdan suggested that conspiracy is not a war crime, that it has not historically been a war crime. That, too, seems to be at odds with the statement, declarative statement in the bill that these are crimes that have traditionally been triable by military commissions. So the ex post facto problem, it seems to me, is still on the table and one which we should explore. The third issue I want to raise is what seem to be some interesting and perhaps peculiar limits on military commission jurisprudence. The bill states that there shall be no invocation of foreign or international law in these war crime cases, and also that there should be no relationship between commission cases trying war crimes and courts martials that could also try war crimes, that the jurisprudence of these two should be separate. I think Gene is going to take that up for us, at least in the first instance. Next, as this was discussed also briefly on the earlier panel, the bill, although it deals primarily with the military commissions, also includes amendments to the War Crimes Act. Now, the issue here purportedly is potential criminal liability for interrogators in what President Bush has referred euphemistically to as the program. This is the program in which CIA officials have engaged in, here I'm quoting again, quote, rough tactics. So there's a concern that in order to keep the program going, in order to permit these rough tactics, which are necessary, we need to immunize CIA agents and perhaps others from liability for war crimes. The way to do that, according to this legislation, is to define specific offenses as grave breaches of Common Article 3, presumably then implicitly defining others as not grave breaches of Common Article 3. Now, the questions, I think, here, there are two questions that are raised. First is whether Congress, by doing this, is implicitly authorizing interrogation tactics that don't rise to the level of torture, but that nonetheless violate Common Article 3. And secondly, if that's the case, if Congress isn't implicitly rewriting the Geneva Conventions, and in particular, writing out of the Geneva Conventions the requirements, the prohibition on outrages upon personal dignity. The final issue, again, which was raised in the first panel, I think we can get into in some greater depth here, is about the bill's seeming intention to strip away the right of habeas corpus, not only of detainees who were charged before military commission, but of all detainees at Guantanamo, including the vast majority of whom have not been charged in the past and very likely never will be charged in the future. And Christine, I think, is going to take the lead on that. So that's the general overview. What I'd like to do is to ask each of the panelists to take no more than 5 minutes to give some initial thoughts and reactions, and then we'll get into these issues in greater detail. Anyone? Gene, do you want to start us off?
I'll be happy to start.
Thank you.
First of all, I'm delighted to be on this panel. and not only in my own capacity, but as personally, but as head of the National Institute of Military Justice, we're very concerned with these issues. We participated in a variety of capacities, including filing amicus briefs and testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee in July. Speaking of Congress, I have to confess that I'm a member of the New York Bar, and I remember once seeing on a lawyer's office wall in New York a sign that said, when the legislature is in session, no man's life or property is secure. And I'm sure that's a commentary on the New York, the Solons who work in Albany. But I must say I'm extremely discouraged at the way the legislative process has been working. From 9/11 on, if you really go back that far. But most particularly since the Detainee Treatment Act was passed last year, the propensity of Congress to conduct important business out of the public eye and to engage in hearings that seem to lead nowhere and have no palpable effect, no demonstrable effect on the resulting work product is very disturbing to me. It would be tempting to propose a rule that would provide that no compromise achieved between the hours of sunset and sunrise shall be immortalized in legislation, except by, let's say, a supermajority, say, three-quarters vote in each House. Something like that perhaps could be considered. And unfortunately, we're in the middle of yet another of these rolling midnight understandings that are sort of dropped on us without explanation, without the kind of materials that would be developed in a congressional hearing, and everyone is left to sort of tease out whatever meaning seems to be warranted, a process that gets increasingly cumbersome and unreliable the more tiers there are on the layer, on the legislative layer cake. You have to drill down layer after layer after layer to find out what it is the compromisers, I don't mean that in an adverse sense, the parties to the compromise, thought they were achieving, much less why. Just one sort of more substantive point, if I can, although I believe the legislative aspect of this is as important as any, in fact. And law schools do give courses on legislation. I think law professional teachers of law do try to weave in the legislative process. But the more attention is paid to the legislative process per se in this, the more concerning it is. And I think that's a theme that, you know, maybe is the subject of another panel, but it is an important theme. Congress has the power to define and punish offenses against the law of nations. And this goes to, I'll just give a little, tidbit on this question of retroactivity, which I think is quite a fair one and quite an important one. There was a plurality in Hamdan for the proposition that conspiracy was not an offense under the law of war. We don't know where Justice Kennedy would have come out on that had he voted on it. To me, a very interesting question is to try to ponder, and I don't have an answer to this, but to try to ponder what measure of discretion, deference, the Supreme Court would pay to an express congressional determination as to whether conspiracy was an offense known to the law of war or the law of nations prior to enactment of will be the Military Commissions Act of 2006. Is this an area where the Supreme Court will insist on its own primacy, as it has in some other areas? and that Congress can, in important respects, not overrule a legal judgment of the court? Or is it an area where, because it's a textual allocation of responsibility, quite a particular one, a specific one, to the legislative branch, that the kind of primacy the Supreme Court might assert in another area, it will refrain from asserting here? That's, I think, a very profound question, and perhaps we can get into it. I don't know what more, you know, I can offer on it aside from raising the question, but it's one that I think is troublesome, particularly and important, particularly because, without regard to the 14 additional people who have been transferred recently to Guantanamo Bay, I believe, and General Hemingway and Major Fleener can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that all 10 of the current defendants before military commissions are accused of conspiracy, and I believe in 7 of the 10 cases, they're accused only of conspiracy. So this has some very, very real consequences. Anyway, I'm sorry, I've taken maybe a little longer than I meant to.
That's true. Thank you. Christine?
Sure. Thank you for having me here. I'd like to pick up on something that an astute young gentleman in the audience said towards the end of the last panel, which had to do with the CSRTs, or the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, and the procedures that were used to actually detain all the individuals who are there. And the reason I want to bring that in is because if you've been reading the papers about the legislation that is about to pass or has been thrown back and forth, is that two very large disputes are over the use of secret evidence and the use of coerced evidence. And in some ways, the debate over whether that is fair or not fair for the military commissions procedure is largely irrelevant, because those very procedures, the use of secret evidence and the use of coerced evidence, were used in the CSRTs to actually detain the people who are now unlawful enemy combatants, who may never be charged, and even if they are charged and acquitted, will still be unlawful enemy combatants and detained on the basis of secret evidence and coerced evidence, the very procedures that we're now debating whether they're fair as part of a military commission or not. So in many ways, I think that the young gentleman was right. I mean, we are debating, you know, legislation for very few people. This is for 24 people at most, when you've got 400 and, I can't do math because I'm a lawyer, but 420-something people who will never really be affected by the preclusion of secret evidence or the preclusion of evidence based on coercion. So it's in many ways sort of an irrelevant debate. It's a great one, and I'm glad that, you know, that Congress is doing it. But what really needs to happen is a debate over the very processes that by which we are detaining people indefinitely. That's a life sentence. When we talk about the war on terrorism, I mean, there's just like the war on drugs, or as somebody mentioned earlier, the Cold War. I mean, that's ridiculous. In July of this year, I was in Guantanamo visiting my former clients who were part of the Rasul appeal and are currently part of the Al-Oda appeal in the D.C. Circuit Court, and I was just completely overjoyed. Everyone was, Hamdan just came out, and it was, you know, just amazing, amazing Supreme Court decision, and frankly, they could have cared less. They could have cared less, because they knew after Rasul, I was allowed to go visit them for the first time, and they knew that the Supreme Court decision, the highest court in the land, can just essentially be reversed by legislation. And that's what Congress did with the Detainee Treatment Act. And I'm going to go into the habeas corpus aspects of the Detainee Treatment Act and this bill in more detail. But the people who this affects, you know, knew that the legislature can just do whatever it wants. It can pass unconstitutional legislation, and then it takes forever and a day to contest it in court. So how much longer will 400 and something people have to be there and never be charged and never be, you know, subject to these what we call really great fair military commission procedures? You'll never get the fairness of these because they're stuck there by the CSRT procedures. So I just want you to sort of think about that when you think about Supreme Court legislation. and the impact of this legislation. Thank you.
Thanks, Christine. I think the CSRT, the Combatant Status Review Tribunal, has come up now here in this panel. It came up in the previous one. I think when we, once we finish going through with these initial responses and get into the conversation a bit deeper, Christine, I'm going to ask you to explain for our benefit the history and evolution of the CSRT, what it is and what it attempts to do, because I think that will be helpful for all of us. Mr. Fleener?
Thanks, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak today. It's a wonderful privilege to be here, and I thank you guys very much. I need to throw a disclaimer out. I don't speak on behalf of the Department of Defense. I suppose General Hemingway will speak on behalf of the Department of Defense. I'm one of the attorneys that's been detailed to represent one of the Guantanamo Bay detainees before the commission. He's never accepted my representation, so I don't really speak in that capacity either. I suppose I speak as an attorney assigned to the Office of the Chief Defense Counsel, and one of my duties in that job certainly is to engage in public debate, so I appreciate this. I also wanted to, before I give real brief remarks, is to thank General Hemingway for allowing me to have the opportunity to speak not only to you but to other various forums around the country, I guess, really. I was telling Hadar today that you just don't see two military officers sitting in uniforms on opposite sides of issues debating in an open forum very often. And one thing that I will certainly say, while he and I have probably disagreed about many aspects of the military commission system, the one thing I can say without any shadow of a doubt is that I feel as if General Hemingway and the appointing authority, his boss, and probably up to the Secretary of Defense, they recognize that this is an extraordinarily important function, and that the issues are so cutting edge that you need public debate, whether it should be two military guys fighting about issues in public or not. This stuff is so important, it's going to affect our country so much that we don't want to quiet one side of an issue, that we need to have alternate voices. So I appreciate that. I've never felt quieted before by the Office of the Appointing Authority, and I think that is certainly a good thing. I'm going to talk a little bit about the legislation, and I'm going to talk about it from the standpoint of being the practitioner. I was down in Guantanamo Bay. I had four or five sessions on the record in the old military commission system, which really was the second version of the military commission system. This is going to be the third iteration. I can tell you that when I read the Hamdan opinion and when I read the legislation that's come out of both the Senate and the House, I started getting sweaty again, knowing that I'm going to have to go back down to Guantanamo Bay and participate in hearings that I truly believe are fundamentally unfair, and that I truly believe set a horrible standard for America. But it looks like that's what's going to happen again. The legislation that has been proposed by the Senate and then a new version by the House that came out late last night, the legislation really goes against the holding, I think, in Hamdan. And when I read Hamdan and I read the majority opinion in Hamdan, I understand that, you know, and I appreciate Justice Stevens jumping in there and saving the day for me for a few minutes. I felt like a death row inmate getting a stay. But I really got the gist of Hamdan by reading the concurrence by Justice Kennedy. And I think what they were saying is that guys don't have goofy trials. They may have been saying, and I appreciate taking Article 36 of the UCMJ and talking about the president's ability to deviate in rulemaking, and that's just fine and dandy. And however you want to bring in the Geneva Conventions to the law, I appreciate it as a practitioner. But when I read especially Justice Kennedy's concurrence, to me it was just stop having weird trials. Do things like you're supposed to do in America. Have an open trial. Let the guy be present. Let the guy see the evidence against him. Let the guy have counsel of his choice. Let the proceeding, it needs to be transparent. have neutral parties involved in the decision-making process. Now, I certainly don't mean to disparage anybody in the uniform folks in the old commission system, and I imagine I'll see some of them in the new system as well. But those were some of the fundamental flaws in the old system, some of which have been addressed kind of in the new legislation. But I, as a practitioner going down there, I am extraordinarily worried about whether the big picture, well, we're missing the big picture, which is you can pass a 94-page piece of legislation, but stop having show trials. And I'm hoping that, I was hopeful that the public debate would have been such that we wouldn't need to create a different justice system for people who look different from us. But that's what we've decided to do in an election year. At the end of the day, I hope that this debate, at least, or our discussion today, gets you guys thinking about what you're going to be doing as attorneys. Most of you are law students, some of you are practitioners and professors of law. There was nothing worse to me personally than participating in a system where I felt that it just didn't feel right. It doesn't feel like what lawyers do. And I mean that truly. When you become attorneys, and those of you who are attorneys, I want you to imagine practicing in a system where you have ad hoc rulemaking after the fact all the time, where there was no system of precedent, no system of law, and essentially the only system, the only law that applied was the law as prescribed by the executive. It really does strike against the core of the separation of powers concept that our country is founded on, and I'm hoping that through the good sound discretion of the gentleman on my right, that when they draft rules to implement this law, that they draft the rules and do it in a way that tries to bring in those fundamental values that not only are American, but I know you don't want to say are international because we try to opt out of that a lot, and I sort of will mention the French, but that are just the things that you do as human beings. So anyway, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm happy to engage members on the panel, and I'm sure we'll have a good discussion today. Thank you.
Thank you. General?
Well, thank you for being here today. I have to tell you, with four defense-minded attorneys here, I'm just glad this is not a tennis match. One of the things I think that it is important, critically important, to bear in mind is that we're talking about a war. And we're talking about the law of war. And one of the issues that I am constantly confronted with is people who want to craft a criminal justice law enforcement paradigm onto responses to wartime issues. Now, as far as the legislative process is concerned, and some of the things that Gene said are true, but they're true about all legislation that goes through Congress. And quite frankly, in my job, I am engaged frequently, sometimes constantly, in the interagency process. And if you think Congress makes sausage, you ought to see the struggle that goes on in the interagency coordination process. It's every bit as challenging. But you know, one of the problems I think in politics is when people won't compromise. That's what the political process is all about, and that's what we're seeing now. As legislation is made. Now, one of the things that surprises me is the fact that there are a lot of proponents for the international tribunals in the United States. people who laud the rules that are found in those international tribunals. And yet, when some of those are adapted to a U.S. response to a law of war issue, you say, oh, you can't do that. Well, that's not fair. Well, it seems to be fair for the international community. I don't see any problem with adapting some of those procedures for our use here. Now, as far as the Hamdan decision is concerned, I've got some, as my office knows, firmly held beliefs about what the court said and why it said it. But those are irrelevant. It's the law, and I think it's time for Congress to address it, and I'm hopeful that they will. Now, one of the things I mentioned when I was asked to participate in this is I am not going to get into the facts of any of the cases that we have pending. Because of the role that I play in the process, I think it would be inappropriate for me to discuss the facts of any of these cases. But I'll be happy to address any of the issues about the process that we've had in the past, the process that we think, based on the legislation that's pending in Congress, or for that matter, the application of international law to this process.
Well, thank you all for that initial round of comments. I think you raised a number of really important issues for us to delve into deeper, and I am seeing some themes starting to emerge. I think to carry the conversation forward, I want to see if we can keep the conversation maybe down at that end of the table, at least initially, to look a little bit closer at some of the issues regarding procedures that the legislation proposes, and to start to evaluate the fairness of those. And I want to put, I guess, questions to Major Fleener and to General Hemingway simultaneously. And Tom, I think we'll start with you on this, but let me just get the questions out to both of you.
Which Tom?
Well, we're both Tom. I know him as General.
As do I. Let me start with Major Fleener. Major, let's... what I want to ask you to do, you described in general terms the old system and suggested that the new system keeps many of what you see to be the deficiencies. You described the new procedures as fundamentally unfair. You talked about weird trials, show trials, goofy trials.
I always use those words.
Right. Someone on this panel one time called them kangaroo courts. I'm not saying who that was, but... what I want to ask you to do is to look and help us understand in greater detail what you see to be the problems with evidentiary standards in particular proposed by the bill. And if I can ask you to talk in particular about the standards that the new bill proposes for the use of coerced statements, and to the extent that you want to address issues such as hearsay and classified evidence, please feel free to do so. What I then want to do is ask General Hemingway to take up the conversation. The question that seems to me is overarching here, and General, your comments have raised this already, is what is the framework under which we evaluate the sufficiency of these standards? It seems clear under Hamdan that a strict criminal justice paradigm is not the one that applies, at least not one that we are familiar with in the domestic context. We know, at the very least, that Common Article 3 is one that does apply. And so after hearing from Major Fleener, General, I'd like you to respond, if you can, on the question of whether you think that the standards, the evidentiary standards in particular, proposed by the legislation, comport with Common Article 3. Okay. Tom? Major?
Sure. Some of the main concerns that I see in some of the evidentiary issues that the new bill has, and I say the new bill, the one that came out late last night, and they put some tricky twists into between the new bill and the Senate's version that's been out for a few days. Here's how it's going to work, essentially, in a nutshell. The government can use no evidence that's derived from torture can be admitted in a trial. That's a good thing. That only came about a little while ago, though. and that was probably March 2005, April 2005, sometime around that time frame. After I engaged in had a colloquy with the chief presiding officer about sticking needles in people's eyes and whether that evidence is going to be admitted, and he said, "Well, I can't. They'll have a tough row to hoe, but I can't say I'm not going to exclude that evidence." And people just gasped. And then about 2 weeks later, DOD came out with instruction saying no evidence derived from torture, which can be admitted, which is a good thing. Thank goodness we had a discussion with Colonel Brown back on the record. Otherwise, I don't know if that instruction would have come out. The new bill, both bills allow evidence or prohibit evidence that's derived from torture. The problem is that they grab the DTA a little bit and then and talk about evidence that's derived from coercive techniques other than those of torture. And they grab the date of the DTA, and I understand as lawyers you have to use the DTA as a setting a standard for the date of when you can admit coerced testimony that is violative of the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendments versus coerced testimony that's not violative of the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendments. Unfortunately, coerced testimony can be admitted in these hearings, and no one is talking about the problem with coerced testimony, which is it's not that we don't admit coerced testimony because it's not the Christian thing to do. That's not what we do in America. It's because it's not reliable. I mean, coercion goes back to the voluntariness standard the Supreme Court talks about. You don't admit coerced testimony because if I'm coercing you and making you give statements that you don't want to give, you wouldn't ordinarily give, I've overcome your will, that's probably the statements I'm giving probably just aren't that true. However, we're going to admit that stuff into evidence. That's horrific, but it's in both bills. And the timeline of December 30th of 2005, anything after December 30th of 2005, any statements that were obtained after that date can't be in violation of the 8th, 5th, and 14th Amendments, which I guess necessarily means anything before then can be in violation of those amendments. The interesting twist to all this is that every statement that's been taken is before December 30th of 2005, so I appreciate the DTA. That's nice. It means nothing. We're going to admit coerced statements into evidence, which is bad. The problem is it gets worse when you allow hearsay to be admitted and you have this weird classified evidence privilege, which is very, very, very expansive, like Senator Graham said, the greatest classified evidence privilege in American law. It sure is. Essentially what it means is the United States can withhold virtually everything from the accused. Methods, sources, means of interrogation, whatnot are all going to be classified. Here's how it's going to play out. The United States and the interrogators will assume they didn't torture somebody back prior to December 2005. They certainly have no evidence. I'm not saying they were torturing people. We'll just say it was really, really coercive. And it was a technique that's not torture, but it's really coercive. Well, they can use that evidence, but they're not going to bring the guy that they coerced into giving all these statements that may or may not be reliable. They're not going to bring him to testify because they don't have to, because they can use the hearsay provision. And so you think maybe they'll bring in the interrogator, the guy who took the statements from the unknown guy in the unknown location that we're not going to bring in, that we coerced to get the information from. We'll just bring in the interrogator and admit the statement against my guy that way. No, they're not going to do that either, because the interrogator is essentially a source as well, and the methods of his interrogation are classified. So they're not going to bring the interrogator in. They'll be bringing in the interrogator's buddy to admit the interrogator's statement that he took from the guy that was coerced. And now, the bill says we get to confront his accusers. That's lovely, that fourth-person hearsay, easy to confront, even if I could confront that evidence. Unfortunately, when I get into I can't find out who took the actual statement, and I can't find out how the statement was actually taken because that technique is classified. So there is literally no way to show that the statement is unreliable. And the burden, interestingly enough, on the hearsay evidence is they put the burden on the defendant to show that the information is unreliable, or they put a little bit of a 403 balancing test in the rule about 403, but not much of one. We'll just focus on the reliability. The burden is on me to show it's unreliable, yet I can't talk to the guy who gave the statement. The guy who took the statement's name is classified. How the statement was taken was classified, yet you somehow get to confront the guy. That's horrible. I mean, I would hope. I painted the picture that it doesn't sound fair. That's how it's going to work, which is sort of similar to how it was going to work in the old system. So we can call it a compromise bill on the use of torture and whatnot. It doesn't appear to be much of a compromise to me. The only provision that they really allow the person, it looks like in the new bill, is that they allow the presence of the accused, which is a good thing. Because that's one of those things you just have, you should do in a free society. But is actually presenting the evidence and getting to the truth and focus on reliability of statements that people are making. The new bill, the old bill, the old system appears to all essentially be the same. And what that essentially means is the government present whatever evidence you want in whatever form you want. And like Admiral Hudson said, and I'm paraphrasing, you're guilty. We're not going to tell you how. We're not going to tell you why. But trust us, we're guilty. This is not quite as bad, because at least the guy gets to sit there and be told that firsthand that you're guilty. We're not going to tell you how or why, rather than being told after the fact. But it certainly violates what we consider to be some sort of fundamental trial principles.
General, can I ask you? Again, with regard to the specific issues that Major Fleener has addressed on coerced testimony and hearsay, but also with the standards of evidence more broadly as you understand them in the proposed bill, could you address whether you think that these comport with Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions?
Well, the statute that I've reviewed, I think, comports with Common Article 3. Now, what Major Fleener has given you is his view of what he thinks the prosecution will do. Now, statements that have been taken from people over the course of time appear in a variety of ways. They appear in what are called Forms 40. These are statements that have been taken by people from the law enforcement agencies of the military departments. And they also appear on Forms 302, which are forms that the FBI uses on which to record statements that they have taken. And then there are statements that have been taken by intelligence interviewers. All of the Forms 40, all of the 302s have, since I got this job, been unclassified and have been provided to all defense counsel. So the amount of total amount of information that is provided versus the amount that is classified weighs quite heavily toward the unclassified. Now I'm still in the process of working with the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence to set in process some machinery that will result in a declassification process that works with much greater dispatch than I've been faced with to date. And we hope to have that done within the next month. But as for the 10 cases that were proceeding with before we were restrained by the courts, the chief prosecutor had announced that they planned to do all of those cases in open proceedings. And the only time that any of the proceedings were closed were, in fact, when the defense counsel wanted to conduct a voir dire examination of a commissioned member about a classified assignment to which they'd been assigned. Now, we've also changed our selection process, so hopefully that won't even come up again. But the legislation now would permit the exclusion of the public, but not the exclusion of the defendant. It's very similar to the process that you would find in federal district court or in a trial by courts martial under military rule 505. So to that extent, I think that it's a significant improvement from the challenges that we were faced with before. Now, the as far as the hearsay rule is concerned, they put additional limitations. It's not just all hearsay goes in. It says it may be admitted if the proponent of the evidence makes known to the adverse party sufficiently in advance to provide the adverse party with a fair opportunity to meet the evidence, the intention of the proponent to offer the evidence and the particulars of the evidence, including information on the circumstances under which the evidence was obtained. That's much more detailed than you find in any of the international tribunals that currently exist in terms of a standard of admissibility. Now, it's interesting, this debate on hearsay is a debate that occurs only in Anglo-Saxon countries. You know, the overwhelming majority of the world does not, in any of their judicial proceedings, recognize the hearsay rule. And what is important is whether or not the trier of fact and the judge is satisfied that the information that they're about to introduce is reliable. And there are standards encompassed in the pending legislation that will require them to make that determination.
Gene and Christina, I want to invite you to join in on this conversation. Do you have any comments on the evidentiary issues?
Well, the question of hearsay, I guess, remains unresolved the question of classified information remains unresolved, as I understand what General Hemingway was saying. In other words, we don't know if there's going to be material evidence that's withheld because it's classified. As I hear you, that's still up in the air and has to be resolved.
Well, according to the legislation, if it's introduced, you can exclude the public from the hearing, but you can't exclude the defendant.
Right.
Which is a major improvement from the situation that we were faced with prior to this legislation.
Right, and indeed.
And for that matter, how does it differ from what you would find in federal district court?
Or a court martial.
Right.
Right. Although, you know, to be, historically correct, there was a school of thought on the Hill that was perfectly willing to keep some evidence from the accused.
Well, whether it's historically correct or not matters not one bit if it's not in the legislation now. That's what we're concerned with. I'm not concerned with how they got there as long as they get to the right place at the end.
It's not just classified evidence and whether something is classified secret or not. It's this protected information with protective orders that are in place. And the protected information is information that is not classified, but you just can't let the guy know what it is. So that's fine and dandy to provide information that's not classified to the defense attorney, but I can't tell my guy who the guy was, when the statement was taken, how the statement was taken. That's all protected information I can't share with the defendant. So I truly believe that this debate on the access to evidence and the use of the evidence might not be. I think classified evidence really is a red herring that, I guess, as a person who didn't like the legislation, I kind of enjoyed floating around out there. My concern more is protected information or what kind of information the defendant, who's the guy who's going to be doing the time, is able to see.
Let me ask this question. I mean, isn't it true that a person who was accused would have either great difficulty or would find it impossible to find out what interrogation technique was employed in obtaining a particular statement. Isn't that right? Can anybody answer that?
I don't know that it would be impossible.
I can answer that.
I think it depends on. I'd have to look at a case by case basis. Of the cases that I have had pending so far, I haven't had any trouble at all finding out what techniques were used.
Christine?
Well, as defense counsel general, you might be privy to information that perhaps I have not, but without revealing classified information, I have looked at the interrogation summary and all of the classified documents relating to my former clients that are sort of, again, direct summaries of the interrogation. Is that so? No way to tell what sort of methods were used at all, and that the information that was provided to me was supposed to be the entirety of the information against my client. So I don't think there is any way to tell. And the difference is too is no matter what information I'm given, I can't share it with my client. So how am I supposed to even have a meaningful discussion about his interrogation or the techniques that were used on him, or the things or statements that he said that he might have said under duress or while he was being waterboarded?
Well, you are, I think, comparing your experience in a habeas case with a military commission case. I'm not here to address the rules that the court imposed or supervised in habeas cases. That's a responsibility of the Department of Justice. All I can address are those processes and procedures that we use in trials by military commission. Now, we have disclosed, we've had a robust disclosure process in all of these proceedings. Just using the Hamden case as an example, we had to put the information we provided defense counsel onto CDs because it amounted to 18,000 pages of information. So there's been a very, very robust disclosure. Now, when you get a statement, the question sometimes to me sounds like, when did you quit beating your wife? Because there's an implication, well, what methods were used implies that there was some form of coercion used. 99.9% of the cases that I've seen, the method used was sitting the person down in a chair and interviewing them and interrogating them. If you want to call that a method, that is the predominant method that the people have used to get this information.
Why have we spent all this time then for the last 6 weeks worrying about torture on the Hill? I don't understand it then. If it never comes up, then Congress has wasted an enormous amount of time.
Well, you know, there's been lots of allegations of it, but that doesn't mean number one that it has occurred, or number two that it's not worth worrying about.
But the President of the United States has said it's critical to the prosecution of the global war on terrorism to be able to continue the use of alternative, I forget his catchword. Methods
well,
of interrogation.
You want to talk about military commissions, or do you want to talk about other federal agencies? I'm here to talk about military commissions, and military commissions only, and the evidence that's going to be admissible in those.
But the 14 people who have most recently, I'll call them Guantanamo 14, were until very recently held by parts of the United States government other than the military. And therefore, one must assume they were interrogated by people other than the military, and one therefore must assume that the evidence to be presented will either on the prosecution side or the request of the defense in terms of, exculpatory matter or inculpatory matter, have to be turned over. So I don't, if it is so critical to have those kinds of interrogation techniques, and if it is important, as the president has concluded it is, having labeled these 14 people terrorists, to bring them to the bar of justice, something I profoundly agree with, because I think it is important that the criminal process be brought to bear, I don't understand how one can cabin off things that may have been done by other agencies of the government from things done by personnel who wear a uniform.
Since I'm having so much difficulty generating conversation on this topic, I'm going to try to move us along in just a minute, but before I do, I want to pose a very narrow question to General Hemingway, and Major Fleener, I want to give you the opportunity to speak again to some of the issues that have come up in this portion of our colloquy. The question I have for you, General, is whether you believe that Article 75 of Protocol 1 of the Geneva Convention of 1949 ought to be used as a measure of the fairness of the procedures being proposed in the military commissions.
Boy, that's a, you must know my background. Let me put it this way. I'm satisfied that the statute will meet that standard. But we've got a semester's worth of class here that's buried in that question. Because I'm not convinced that Article 75 of Protocol 1 is customary international law. We could go on for days on that, because I've spent a considerable amount of time looking at that issue. But to be concise, to answer your question, I think the legislation will comply with the requirements of Article 75, whether it is or is not customary international law.
Okay. Major Fleener, do you want to weigh in further on this topic before we move on?
Yes, but just briefly, I have my protective orders in front of me from the Abba Hul Military Commission, and all the statements that are taken, the 302s and the Form 40s, are classified as professional use only, law enforcement sensitive, and I can't share any of that with the guy. I also can't let him know any names or anything that
you're talking about the rules that existed under the old system.
I am, and that's what I thought you were talking about as well. But I think I disagree with the general. I think that it is customary international law. I think that and I'm not an expert in international law, but I've talked to experts on international law, and they all agree that it's conditional protocol 1, at least Article 25, is customary international law. I'm hopeful that the legislation complies. I don't think it necessarily does. Well, I don't think it does. But I hope that it is. My hope in all this, Munir, is that, and I think that this is why I think the general has such an important job, is that the rules, the statute is going to be no good. And that's, I know that's not a very good legal definition, but it's just not going to be a good statute. And what's going to come down to is whether, and I truly believe this, whether folks in the convening authority, appointing authority's office, whether the prosecutors think big picture and recognize, what do I need to do? The statute lets me do anything I want to do. What do I need to do in order to have a fair trial? And do I need to hide hearsay through fourth persons? No. I don't need that. I'm going to try and bring the people there, make the proceeding as open and transparent as possible. So whether the statute, Article 75 is customary international law or not, whether the statute is going to comply with it or not, I think that we can actually turn this thing through more of a as-drafted, as-applied analysis of statutory construction and like a constitutional interpretation. And I think the onus is going to be on the general and the good people he has working for him. He has the ability to take every loophole that the Congress gives him in the war on terror and have trials that really don't to conform with recognized standards, or he can not do that and say, let's have fair trials. I appreciate the opportunity that Congress has given me not to, but as applied to this particular case, I'm going to make the guy see all the evidence. I'm going to make the guy have a confrontation of the witnesses. I'm going to have a transparent process. So I think the general certainly has the most important job from now on.
Well, just in terms of where we're going, we have until 1 o'clock. I'm going to try to reserve the last 15 minutes for questions from the audience. And so I hope we'll be able to return to some of the topics that we've engaged on thus far. What I want to do at this point, there are two, there are a lot of issues here that we could talk about. There are two big issues that I'd want to make sure we spend some time on. The next one I'd like us to talk about is what the statute says, the proposed statute says about the jurisprudence of the commissions. And then we're going to talk about the habeas stripping provisions. With regard to the jurisprudence, I think that for those of you, many of you here are law students, you all know that the rules are the starting point and hardly the end of the analysis on any legal issue, and that we rely upon interpretations by judges and the jurisprudence to help us understand what the rules actually mean, to construct a context and a history, and to provide us with the guidance necessary to make decisions in the future. For those of us who have practiced in the old military commission system, I think that we certainly one of the threshold questions that was presented was, what is the jurisprudence of the system? Can we look to decisions of federal courts? Can we look to decisions of international courts? Can we look to decisions from courts martial or from historical military commissions? I think it's fair to say that that question was never given a definitive answer. In our experience, I think that what we got was sense that what we need to do was engage in a kind of pinging, which is send out an inquiry, and if you get a hit, we'll let you know, and if not, keep sending out inquiries. You'll discover the law through the process of practicing. What's interesting on this issue in the legislation is that there are several provisions that seem to go to this question of what the jurisprudence of the commissions ought to be and what its relationship ought to be to other bodies of law. So I want to ask Gene to describe for us what these provisions say and to provide some context for them.
Right. The background is quite interesting. In December, the Army lawyer was kind enough to publish an article that I co-authored with Colonel Sullivan, the Chief Defense Counsel, and former professor of mine, Professor Detlev Watts from Harvard Law School, with the catchy title, "A Military Commission Law," because we were having trouble figuring out what law governs in these proceedings. And what actually stimulated this article was when there was, I believe they're called POMs, a presiding officer memorandum, that the chief presiding officer, the presiding officer issued that defined military commission law at one point. And the part that, you know, made my eyes grow big was the paragraph that said, "These rules and no others," I'm paraphrasing here, but that was the gist of it, "these rules and no others will be the rules of decision in military commissions." And that seemed odd because it excluded, you know, bodies of law that one would have thought would be referred to, whether it's military justice, case law, of which there are scores of volumes now, or the law of the federal courts, or foreign law, and so forth. And so Professor Watts and Colonel Sullivan and I came up with, we tried to analyze what little experience there was in terms of pleadings that were available, and we came to a remarkable insight, which was that regardless of the "and no other" clause of this POM, you have to get into the internal vocabulary, the POM rule, people were citing law from all kinds of sources. They were citing things from the Manual for Courts Martial. They were citing the military rules of evidence. They were citing things from the federal courts. They were citing things from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. They were citing things, I'm pretty sure, from the international criminal tribunals. And, you know, there was, at the time that we wrote this, I think in late, it was finished in late November or so, there was very little by way of decisional law from the appointing authority. But what little there was, I think it had to do with challenges at the time, what little there was suggested that, much like the attorneys appearing before the military commissions, by the way, on both sides, prosecution and defense, the appointing authority, and here I'm referring to Major General Altenberg, who was a wonderful officer and a great patriot, was also referring to law in a very eclectic and one would have thought appropriate manner. So that's the sort of short version of where we were until Hamdan. What you see in the Senate bill, and I confess that I haven't had a chance to study this morning's version, which is the House bill, which claims to have been released at 4:46 p.m. or have been finalized at 4:46 p.m. yesterday, but it only made the rounds this morning. What you see on the part of the drafters of the what we'll call the Senate bill is an interest in the same impulse, let's say, that was apparent in Bapam on the and no others clause. And it comes up in a number of respects. It's a focus on what is and what is not authoritative, or not even authoritative, helpful, or not even helpful, permissible in the discourse before the military commissions. Specifically, and it comes up in a variety of ways. There is a sense that the law to be generated under what will be Chapter 47A of Title 10, which is the military commissions chapter, has to be hermetically sealed from the law developed over 55 years or so under Chapter 47, which is the Uniform Code of Military Justice. What it says, and I'm just going to refer to the page numbers because it's too cumbersome to jump around with the sections, but it says that findings, holdings, interpretations, and other precedents of military commissions may not be introduced or considered in any hearing, trial, or other proceeding of a court-martial.
Yeah, which one?
This is the Senate.
I'm just found the
okay.
Same provision.
Page 8.
In
yeah.
The House.
The findings, holdings, interpretations, and other precedents of military commissions under this chapter may not form the basis of any holding, decision, or other determination of a court-martial convened under this chapter. So there's this anxiety that nothing said, done, written, held, or observed in the context of a military commission should be permitted to spill over into the military justice context. Now, the intellectual and jurisprudential implications of this and the policy implications are disturbing. What it suggests is, on a certain level, this is not the same sterling system that we have for the trial of misconduct by our personnel. And to draw an institutional connection, this provision may have some sort of behind the scenes or subliminal connection with the allocation of appellate responsibility for review of military commissions. Because if you had review by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces of military commissions, which the working version does not have, it would be well nigh impossible to ask those five judges to put entirely out of mind the entire body of jurisprudence that they were responsible for administering when reviewing courts martial. Anyway, that's sort of a paradox. It's a preoccupation that the drafters have. And it comes up again in another guise when you're talking about the definition of offenses under the War Crimes Act, which has a basically no foreign law clause in it. Now, I'm just going to impose on you one more minute to say the framers of this legislation, and now I'm talking about the second point, the foreign allergy problem. The framers are not the only lawyers, many of them are lawyers, some maybe not, but the framers are not the only people on the globe who have questioned the reference to foreign law. It is a fact. There are justices on the Supreme Court who feel this way, and lest we get dewy-eyed about the mother country, there is a rule that was passed by the Lord Chief Justice of England that strongly discourages reference to foreign law, unless you have a really, really cogent reason for saying it. So there, respected sources in our legal culture have been concerned by this. The implications are interesting. I think that standpoint is a hard sell in this building, and it's a hard sell to me personally. I think there is wisdom that emerges from other contexts, and I wouldn't want to close my eyes to it. But those are some of the intellectual or sort of institutional implications.
Jean, let me ask you if I've got this right, because there are the institutional and the theoretical considerations here, but there's also a practical consideration here. It seems to me you're describing two related phenomena, but as you've described, distinct. One is the issue of what role, if any, foreign law plays in determinations of, for example, what is a war crime.
Yes.
And that's something that the legislation introduces as prohibition on foreign law with respect to amendments to the War Crimes Act. Then there's the first issue that you started us off with around essentially quarantining the law of military commissions from any other source of law. Now, let me see if I have this right.
Quarantining from that source of law to which the mind naturally runs, which is the law developed under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is the closest thing we have in this country to a body of military law. And if you accept the paradigm that we are in a time of war and that the law of war is the governing principle, mm-hmm. the governing atmospheric theme, mm-hmm. then reference to that body of law would seem to be a natural proposition.
Okay. Well, here's the question I want to ask, though, because the legislation only authorizes use of military commissions for non-citizen unlawful enemy combatants, right? Now, so they can be charged with war crimes in a military commission, but others can be charged for war crimes before a court-martial, right? For example, a U.S. soldier or presumably a lawful enemy combatant could be tried for a war crime not in a military commission, but in a court-martial.
All right, and you're now announcing Mounir's paradox. Mounir's paradox holds that it is indefensible to close one's eyes when dispensing justice in respect of an enemy combatant in a military commission while leaving the door open to Major Fleener and his uniformed colleagues as defense counsel in a general court-martial trying a war crime by our own personnel, or for that matter, trying a foreign POW, let's say, an enemy combatant for a war crime in a general court-martial, because that is permissible under the Uniform Code of Military Justice and remains permissible under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So you would have two different sort of patches in the garden that were walled off from one another, even though both in theory, we're applying the same principles of law.
And let me take it one step further.
I appreciate
anything that you want to name after me, I will take.
All right, well, it's a start.
Let me raise one more issue in this regard, though. You could have two individuals from the very same conflict. This is another issue that I think is left open in the Senate bill. It's complicated by the House bill. But let's assume, just for the purposes of this argument, that a member of the Taliban is considered to be a lawful enemy combatant, and a non-Taliban al-Qaeda member is considered to be an unlawful enemy combatant. Both are picked up in the same raid, in the same battle in Afghanistan. Both are charged with the identical war crime offense.
It's conspiring with one another.
Conspiring with one another. Even if it's a charge that there's unanimity on, that the substantive offense is in fact a violation of the law of war, you would have them going in parallel proceedings where at least the door is a one-way door. It's possible that one could take the law of the court-martial and bring it into the commission, but you couldn't take the law of the commission and bring it into the court-martial. That's the way I read it. Is that right?
Well, It's actually a little more complicated. I thought you were making another point, which was that in one case, you could refer, you know, to your wit's end, to pertinent principles of law from any from any context. In the other case, you were constrained to apply only the law of military commissions. Indeed, only the law, only domestic law of military commissions as prescribed for these particular proceedings. So in one, you might wind up talking about decisions of the International Military Tribunal or things from the ICC or things from, you know, ICTR and so on. And in the other case, the conversation would be much shorter.
All right, so let me in the interest of time, move on. I mean, it just seems to me that there are a number of contradictions that are raised here. If we bring in one a third forum within U.S. law for dealing with war crimes, which would be a prosecution under the War Crimes Act, right? We now have, in the War Crimes Act context, you can't refer to foreign law. But presumably, in a court-martial, one might be able to, because there is no statutory prohibition on that. There's a question of what you can or can't do in the military commission. So just based on forum, we have, it seems to me, a set of potential contradictions. Then there's a set of, and this is related, but there's a set of contradictions we might trace according to status. Are you a lawful enemy combatant, or are you an unlawful enemy combatant? A final set of contradictions I think are worth exploring, and here I am in full professorial mode where I'm raising questions and not answering any of them, is to what extent do the procedures and the protections vary by alienage? If you're a U.S. citizen versus a non-citizen, is there a different jurisprudence based solely on that? And that, too, tracks to where one might be tried.
By the way, there's yet another, for, you know, when next time you address this, the other one is, what's coercion?
Sure.
Because there is a definition of coercion in the UCMJ, Uniform Code of Military Justice, mm-hmm. that applies in two places. It applies to two categories of people, GIs, who commit, you know, any kind of offense, which might be a war crime, not called such, but, you know, a Cali murder, let's say, and people on the other side who wind up being prosecuted in a general court-martial mm-hmm. and are therefore subject to Article 31D, which is the prohibition on coerced statements. So those two categories are subject to one definition of coercion, and everybody else is subject to another definition. Excuse me, everybody tried before a military commission is subject to another definition of coercion. And by the way, there's another definition of coercion that a U.S. district court would apply in trying a case under the War Crimes Act.
Let me sum up this portion of the conversation by saying, for those students who are looking for topics for your comments, there's quite a bit here of unexplored territory. All right, what I want to do for at least a few minutes is turn to Christine to ask your talk about the significance of the habeas stripping provisions. And Christine, you mentioned in your preliminary comments, in many ways, that here's something that's overarching, is pervasive, that reaches all the detainees and not merely, at this point, the 24 that we expect would go before a military commission. Even if we take the prosecution's most liberal estimates of how many people might go before a commission, maybe that's 75 more. So 100 total out of more than 400, around 450. We're talking about three-quarters of people for whom this bill, with respect to the provisions, the procedures for a military commission, are largely irrelevant. In that context, you've urged us to pay more attention to the habeas stripping. I want to ask you to speak to that issue, and also, as you do so, if you could give us a very brief summary of what the CSRT, Combatant Status Review Tribunal, procedure is and how that relates to the habeas issue.
as I said earlier, I think the debate has been somewhat wrongly focused on very particular provisions, and in many ways, it's not just that that the habeas provision in the bill affects those other than those who've been charged. The fact is, no matter how fair or unfair the military commission procedures are, whether you can use foreign law or refer to other determinations, if you don't have habeas, which is what both proposed bills propose to strip, you have no way to challenge whether those procedures are fair. So, you know, if Major Fleener gets his way, then okay, maybe we don't need habeas. But if he doesn't, well then, damn straight we need habeas. How do you challenge the very procedures that are being used to convict you? But that's sort of with respect to the military commissions. But the overarching problem is that you have 400 and something individuals who have been detained there based on procedures, the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, which were, as somebody in the first panel stated, were implemented in response to the Rasool decision. And Rasool was really sort of the first Supreme Court decision that came out saying these guys at Guantanamo need the opportunity to challenge their very detention. And so the CSRTs were a procedure, a military procedure that was put in place. Coerced evidence was allowed, so all this debate about, you know, whether you can use it or not. There was no debate back then. Coerced evidence obtained by coercion, secret evidence, hearsay evidence, essentially, you know, any evidence was used to determine that an individual was an enemy combatant. And that, as I said before, is a life sentence. So even if you're acquitted under fair procedures in the military commissions, you could still be detained as an enemy combatant under what almost anybody would say was sort of unfair procedures, or I might say a kangaroo court procedure, the CSRT. So you've got that background, okay? The Detainee Treatment Act, which was passed last year, in December of last year, essentially stripped the right of habeas to, I'd say, subsequent cases to be able to protest those CSRT procedures and the then military commission procedures. So the DTA, and it provided for a very limited scope of review for both the CSRT procedures and the military commission procedures in the D.C. Circuit Court. So while you could have protested the actual military commission conviction, you could not have protested or challenged in a federal court the actual procedures that were the then military commissions. So the DTA defines the scope of the review, and the current bill, both of them, contain a habeas stripping provision that basically takes away your right to challenge the procedures and limits you to challenging whether the actual hearing complied with the procedures, whether they're good or bad, whether they're good or bad or unfair or completely in violation of the Constitution. And so that, I would suggest, is sort of the I think, the more important and glaring problem that needs to be addressed by legislation. And I will say some law students from here last week and the week before engaged in some lobbying, protesting the stripping of habeas. Let me just add one more thing about habeas, because I can see the general is itching to say something, which is that, yes, this is a unique war, and that very fact, that this is a unique war, actually gives more reason to keep habeas, because we didn't have a war where people were wearing uniforms. In fact, one of the reasons why the administration has supported to deny Geneva Conventions is because people, combatants, were dressed as civilians. So the question is then, did we pick up all the right people? And if you've got plenty of civilians or combatants dressed as civilians, you need something like habeas to allow the individual who may be innocent to detest the procedures, to contest the procedures that were used to detain him.
General, do you want to weigh in on this? And then I'm going to open it up for questions from the audience.
Sure. I'd just like to point out that before you start cloaking all of these people with rights to statutory rights to assert habeas actions, you need to remember that what we are dealing with are wartime enemy combatants. The CSRTs are a process that is much more formalized and detailed than any process offered under Article 5 of the Third Geneva Convention, which simply says you have the right to have a hearing if there's any doubt as to your status. That's all it says. There are no rules, there's no right to counsel, no formality to it, and quite frankly, if you look at some of the Article 5 proceedings that I've observed, There are a couple of guys sitting on empty ammo boxes discussing the circumstances under which this individual in front of them was captured. Now, do you want lawyers with briefcases running around the battlefield all over the world following your troops? I mean, is this a full lawyer employment program or not?
We're in favor of that here at the law school.
Yeah. But my only point is, don't consider this in a vacuum. Just don't consider it as being applicable only to those people who currently are being detained at Guantanamo, because the ramification, the impact of this is far broader than just those 400 plus people.
Christine, do you want to, if people have questions, if you can just make your way up to the microphone.
I just would like to respond to that very briefly, which is that in all past wars, Vietnam, Korea, Kosovo, as far as I understand, the Army regs that incorporate the tribunal and the Geneva Conventions were used to provide hearings to detainees, like you said, right on the battlefield to discuss the circumstances of the capture. So the main problem with the CSRTs is that they were held 2.5 years later, far from the battlefield, without the very people there who had captured them. And part of that problem is because it's less than, I think, 5% of the detainees were actually captured by U.S. forces. So you have a huge gap right there.
Well, we're getting factual issues here now that I would dispute, but go ahead with your questions.
This is not so much a question as a comment, because you were mentioning the Senate legislation, and indeed it's very hard to get through all of this, but as someone said about the late Richard Nixon, that he's the gift that keeps giving, so does the statute. Under one of the substantive crimes, it's very interesting, 95GGG, spying. Any person subject to this chapter 2 in violation of the laws of war. But guess what? Spying has never been, and it is not today, a violation of the laws and customs of the world. The United States and U.S. military manuals have reflected what was customary international law in 1907, was reflected in Article 31. Of the Hague Regulation, which made very clear that a combatant who engages in spying and who rejoins his unit incurs no responsibility whatsoever for his previous acts of espionage and could not be tried by his captor for those acts. If caught in the act of spying, what is permitted to the captor is to try the individual on the basis of deterrence under the domestic law of the capital, not for a violation of the law of the world. There's another good reason, I understand, is that it is better that you're including something that cannot be. The Congress nor the President cannot, by the stroke of a pen, change into a violation of the laws of the something which never has and continues not to be a violation of the law.
That's a very interesting point, and let me add that spying is one of two offenses, the other I think being aiding the enemy, mm-hmm. which are prohibited to any person under the UCMJ. In other words, that qualifies you for a general court-martial as opposed to a military commission. In other words, the prohibition is already there, triable in a general court-martial.
You know, this, if I can just pick up on this, this is the recurring theme now of whether what's included in the bill is in fact declarative of laws of war, or whether this is now introducing, under the guise of a law of war name, offenses that never have been laws of war. And I want to relate this back to the topic of conspiracy, because as Gene mentioned, 7 out of 10 of the detainees who were previously charged under the old system were charged only with conspiracy. And the Supreme Court, or the justices, expressed their view that conspiracy is not a violation of the law of war. This is what I want to raise, and Bob, maybe since you've entered the conversation, I want to invite you to comment on this, and anyone else on the panel. One of the things that the bill does is that it amends the UCMJ, Article 47, not Article 47A, and it adds conspiracy to commit a violation of the law of war as an offense that's triable in court-martial, rather than just being an offense that's triable by military commission. Should we take that as a tacit admission that since it wasn't included as an offense before, that adding it now tells us that this is actually a new charge? Is that a fair reading? This is on page 79 of the Senate bill, if people have it.
Well, invoking my sunset to sunrise clause, it would certainly be fascinating to know what the Senate committee report is going to say on this subject. Presumably, there'll be some comment on it, but and presumably the report, by the way, will be available before the full Senate votes on this matter later this week.
Possibly going to put a person away for life, or possibly convicting them of something. Conspiracy never has been. It is never found in these countries. It has not been. The same thing is with terrorism. The law of war prohibits certain things that are understood to be acts of terror. Many of those things are subsumed already under charges, like deliberately launching an attack against civilians in the knowledge of the civilians, or attacking protected property and so forth. But as terrorism is defined in there, no. Mm-hmm. No, because the law of war has no definition of terrorism. There is not even an accepted international law definition of terrorism. So what you have worked into here are certain things that supposedly are consistent with the law of war, in which the law of war has not even directly addressed through definition. So if you wanted to call, for instance, well, intentionally launching an attack against civilians and so forth, if that is deemed to be an act of terror, fine. It's already there. It's already prohibited. We understand that. But conspiracy to commit these things and other that you now are introducing as substantive crimes, the things that should be consistent with the law of war, that are unknown, and it gets back to the problem that I raised in the first one. The absolute conflation of terrorism with acts of war, and they are not invariably conflatable. Some occur outside of warfare, some can occur during warfare. When they occur during warfare, they are recognized already in international armed conflicts to constitute grave breaches or possibly in non-international armed conflicts, serious violations of the law. But outside of armed conflict and so forth, they cannot be war crimes because they are not committed during war.
If I can just, because I know our time's running out, I want to call attention to a very excellent essay that Ambassador Sheffer has posted in the last day or so on the Jurist website about the common Article 3 issues and the definitions of what is an offense, a grave breach of common Article 3 and so forth, the morass that this legislation creates. And I strongly recommend that for people who are interested in the subject.
Okay, Susanna is here, and I saw someone getting up here. So why don't we can I go here and then back to you, Susanna. Thanks. Can you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Anna Simmel, student here. This question's for General Hemingway. My understanding is that once Congress passes legislation, it'll be up to your office to create specific rules and regulations of the military commission. And so I was just wondering if you could give us a timeline of when you see that process being completed and when ultimately the trials by military commissions will begin.
That's a great question.
Are you sure you're not a political appointee?
Not in this administration.
Yeah, that's a question I get all the time. I have represented that we will be done with our manual in a month, in 30 days from the day the legislation is done. Now, that is not to say it will be approved in 30 days. It'll be out of my office. Now, I've had things fly through the approval process, and I've had some things that have languished. So all I can tell you is our goal is to have it done 30 days from the day that the legislation is enacted. Now, we've already started working on it in those areas where we can. As you have heard today, this has been a bit of a moving target, so that's been somewhat of a challenge. So I'd say at this point, we're no better than maybe 15 to 20% of the way. Now, once that's done, I can't tell you how long it's going to take the Office of the Chief Prosecutor to get the charges going. I would imagine in several of the cases it would be fairly quickly. But they all are going to have to be recharged. The what?
The approval process.
Oh, you mean to approval of charges? Well, they will naturally flow to the Office of General Counsel, the Department of Defense. I can't tell you right now whether or not they plan to throw those into the interagency process, but typically our work is reviewed at least by the Department of Justice and occasionally by the Office of White House Counsel, the National Security Council, and any other agency that thinks it has some equities in the issues. But I would say that as a minimum, it'll be reviewed by the General Counsel of the Department of Defense.
So, can you introduce yourself? And you'll have the last question, unfortunately, because we're out of time.
It's more of a comment than a question, but my name is Susanna Sackwood. I direct the War Crimes Research Office here at the law school. And the comment's related to a comment made by General Hemingway that the rules of the International Criminal Tribunal with regard to procedure and evidence are more permissible than the rules proposed for the military commissions here. And I just wanted to say two things. One is that hearsay evidence is in fact permissible before these tribunals, but there are two things to keep in mind that are pretty important. One is that there is jurisprudence of the tribunal saying that there's an obligation on the court, the chambers, to do an assessment of the indicia of reliability before any of that evidence is admitted. But the other important piece is that with respect to evidence obtained pursuant to coercion, the rules are pretty clear that those aren't permissible. So in other words, Rule 95 of both the International Criminal Tribunal for the Reform of Yugoslavia and Rwanda agrees that no evidence shall be admissible if obtained by methods which cast substantial doubt on its reliability or of its admission, or its admission is antithetical to it and would seriously damage the integrity of the proceeding. So in combination, there is the admissibility of hearsay possibility, but there is a clear prohibition on evidence obtained pursuant to coercive measures.
Well, two things to say. Number one, there is jurisprudence. When the court stood up, there wasn't.
Right.
Now, well, and I think when we're done with these rules and procedures, you're going to find the same result that you have there when it comes to coercion.
Right. The question might be why not learn from that process where we are today with respect to the conversation. But thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our panelists for taking the time to join us, joining our community for this important conversation. I want to thank them for their patience and their candor. Please join me in thanking them. We'll thank Gene in absentia. He had to run out to catch a train. I also want to thank the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law for organizing this. And I want to thank all of you. I think the turnout here was terrific. I think the level of engagement by the students in our community is a reflection of our engagement in contemporary issues more broadly. So I want to thank you for that. I want to encourage you to stay engaged, stay involved with the center, take up these topics in your classes and in your comments, and I look forward to seeing all of you at a future event. Thank you.
Mr.